Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Incoming transmission.
Politics. Not good at politics. Surely there are others who are better suited.
Trek Politics with Mary L. Trump and Bob Seska.
Hello, and welcome to the very first episode of Trek Politics. I'm Mary Trump, here with my amazing co-host, Bob Seska. We're so happy to have you with us today. This will be the first of many shows, and we're kicking it off, Bob, with an interview with the amazing Terry Metalis. But before we get there, I wanted to start with this notion that we, you and I, are somehow single-handedly or double-handedly politicizing the entirely apolitical Star Trek universe. What say you, Bob?
Yes, that's right. We've come to ruin Star Trek for everybody by injecting our liberal woke politics into... No, the truth is, Mary, as we all know, political allegory has always been part of the Star Trek universe. This is something that goes back to the original series. It's never about political parties. It's never about who's going to win or lose the next election or which issue is going through Congress. And so what we're going to be talking about here on this show is that almost on an episode by episode basis across all the different series, all the different movies, everything. I mean, there's a whole series of episodes of Star Trek that we've talked about already as far as topics for this show. A Private Little War is one that from the original series, having to do with the Vietnam War and escalation and the use of certain kinds of weapons. We'll get into that. DS9, there was an episode of DS9 where there was a same-sex kiss. It was called Reunion. In fact, we mentioned that in our conversation with Terry Metalis. We get into that topic. And so as we move forward with each new episode, we'll be covering that and discussing and sort of deconstructing and in some cases debating and maybe even in some cases criticizing how Star Trek handled certain political issues. But sometimes Star Trek gets it wrong, and we'll talk about that too.
Yeah, and there's so much there. Again, it's spanning decades and franchises and TV and movies, as you've mentioned, that we don't need to drag our current political situation into it. You know, this is not a venue for looking at today's politics in America through the lens of Star Trek. What we're trying to do is help people understand the ways in which Star Trek itself has taken head on, in many cases, and sometimes badly, social issues that are still very relevant to us today. So I think it's going to be a fascinating exploration of that. And of course, we get to talk about Star Trek and how much we love Star Trek and why we love it. And along those lines, I think people would really love to know how you first got into it and what about Star Trek when you were a kid just touched a chord that made you a lifelong fan, as I am.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think for me, strangely enough, because I'm of a certain generation, I was born in 1971, and consequently, I was exposed to Star Wars first. And that was kind of the entry point to get into Star Trek, because that's when I started to explore the reruns that were on TV in the Washington, D.C. area where I grew up. And I fell in love with Star Trek because of that. And I was collecting the Mego action figures, and I had, in fact, there's a picture of me on Christmas morning. I think I was 6 or 7 years old. And as a gift, I received the Star Trek utility belt with a communicator and a tricorder. It was the coolest thing in the world. I've got a picture of myself with my footy pajamas wearing the Star Trek utility belt. So I have very, very fond memories of Star Trek from that point of view. And then, of course, the animated series. But I think for me, when it really kicked off was when I was in college and The Next Generation was on. And I picked up on The Next Generation a couple of seasons late. And depending on who you ask, that may be a fortuitous thing because of the first two seasons not being quite running on all cylinders. But by season three, I think that's where I was really, really getting into it and getting exposed to it. And talk about fandom. I was building the Starship models during college. Really attractive to the ladies, by the way. Just, oh, come on over to my place. Check out my AMT Star Trek models. You smell that airplane glue. Yeah, that was fun. But that, yeah, that was me in college. And so that's where it really kicked off. And then into the 90s with Voyager and DS9. And then I kind of fell away from Star Trek for a while when that era of Star Trek kind of went away. It was kind of simultaneous to that. And then Strange New World season one came along. And it was such a revelation as far as, oh my God, they've absolutely captured or recaptured that Star Trek vibe with the episodic storytelling and just hitting all of the right Star Trek notes, the aesthetic, the likable characters, that good feeling that you have at the very end. And then, and of course, Star Trek Picard season three topped it for me. It's just been one of those lifelong things. I think it's been for everybody, you know, so I'm sure it's the same with you.
Yeah, I'm a little older, but so in 1971, I was watching reruns on WPIX Channel 11 in New York. So that was my first experience with science fiction, and I became an avid reader of science fiction, primarily Isaac Asimov, whom I adored. I think I read everything the man wrote, including his nonfiction science articles. Because I was a total geek. But there was something about Star Trek. And don't get me wrong, I love Star Wars. I think I was 12 when the first Star Wars came out. But I am particularly fond of the camaraderie, the consistent teamness of Star Trek. Now, obviously, that exists in Star Wars, but they're separated a lot, and it's chaotic, and it's much more militaristic. I loved the vision of Star Trek. I also thought that Nichelle Nichols, well, as I knew her, Lieutenant Uhura, was one of the coolest people on the planet. I loved the character of Spock. I thought that was fascinating. Yeah. And again, just the togetherness of them and, you know, I did not watch it for its social commentary, shockingly. But that was the other thing. The social commentary didn't get in the way of enjoying the story.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And I think it stayed in reruns forever. So I never stopped watching the original series. And then, like you, I probably got into The Next Generation a little late. And then Deep Space Nine became one of my favorite things. It was I find the world building and the politics in Deep Space Nine fascinating. And I never watched Voyager when it was out. I'm not sure. Maybe I wasn't able to watch more than one Star Trek at a time. I don't really know what happened. But
there was a lot of Star Trek at that time.
There was Enterprise. Yeah. I've seen one episode, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. All right. Am I going to lose my geek cred here? I don't know. Maybe we should cut that part out. but the and of course, I love the movies. So when I guess Discovery would have been the next, after a years long absence of Star Trek TV shows, Discovery was announced. So I was very excited about that. And the possibilities Discovery offered for spinoffs. Of which we finally did get Strange New Worlds, which I agree with you is just phenomenal. And has also has the promise of being a multi-year series. You know, we know Picard is over, but now we have the promise of legacy. Hopefully, keep writing letters, people. It will matter.
Star Trek Legacy, that hashtag, yeah.
Yeah. So the way the show has grown and the way, or I should say the universe of Star Trek has grown, the way it continues to grapple with issues that are relevant to all of us, the way it continues to miss the mark sometimes. Hmm. I mean, it's all just fascinating. And to be able to talk about that in the midst of some pretty trying times we're living in, you know, it gives us something to hope for, to strive for. And again, it's always been a model of how we can be and what humanity can choose, I guess.
Exactly. That's a really good point. And in fact, I think we discussed that a little bit with Terry Metalis, where I'm really into the utopian future aspect of Star Trek, the promise that it offers humanity now, because ostensibly the Star Trek timeline is an offshoot of our current timeline. It's our times, but, you know, 200, 300 years into the future. And if we make all the right decisions, then maybe we can have the Enterprise D soaring through the cosmos. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's one of those things that offers so much hope and optimism. Now, granted, it had to go through, and this is in the Star Trek timeline, that it had to go through some turbulent times that we seem to be right on the cusp of, as far as a second Civil War, eugenics war, World War III, as outlined in the first episode or the Strange New Worlds pilot.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, just a quick mention of that, since Strange New Worlds is premiering season two right now. That first episode of Strange New Worlds embodies so much of what we're going to kind of be hitting upon on this show. The very fact that out of that first episode, within that first hour, it's like, okay, you know what? We're going to lay it all out. Here comes January 6th.
Yep.
Thump.
Yeah, I agree. I like the fact that they're not pulling punches, but I also like the fact that they so clearly understand their mandate here, because a lot of people will say, well, that's just politicizing Star Trek. Well, if you think that storming the Capitol is a matter of politics, then maybe you need to reconsider that. This is because what I believe their message is that we cannot survive if we attack the very institutions we participate in together. You know, so that's, as far as I'm concerned, that's not a Republican versus Democratic thing. That's a pro-democracy versus anti-democracy thing. And that reminds me of something that you mentioned earlier, having to do with the right way or the wrong way to politicize Star Trek. Somebody we both know and revile tweeted something a while back, a few years ago, that's a perfect example of what we're not going to do in this show.
Yeah, and that was Ted Cruz in 2015. He said, I think it is quite likely that Kirk is a Republican and Picard is a Democrat. No, there's so many things wrong with that. First of all, political parties, applying modern day political parties in the 21st century to something that's going on in the 23rd century, 24th century, on into the 25th century, is just a huge mistake. And that's politicizing Star Trek, as far as I'm concerned. And when it comes to Kirk and the question of ideology and the times that they live in the future, we're talking about a federation that is essentially multicultural space communism. I mean, when it comes right down to it, we're talking about a democracy that also has this economic communistic angle to it, where there is no more money, there is no drive, there is no profit motive that exists in that universe. And so to begin to apply Republican and Democrat to someone that ostensibly exists 200 years from now is not only a mistake as far as just it being anachronistic, but also in terms of the political culture of the United Federation of Planets and Starfleet. While it may have that nautical, Navy, military vibe to it with Starfleet, the fact of the matter is that it's an organization that's built around eliminating a lot of the things that, quite frankly, are revered in modern times, including capitalism, which no longer exists. Certainly it exists among certain pockets and civilizations, the Ferengi, for example, but not in the Federation, for sure.
Yeah, and in fact, people in the Federation cannot understand the kind of capitalism that drives the Ferengi or drives us, quite frankly. Yeah. And it's that kind of, that ability to overcome the kinds of institutions that I think limit us as human beings, that again makes Star Trek and the Star Trek universe a place I really want to live.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And you know, going back to Strange New Worlds, there's an episode also that we're going to definitely cover in a future episode of the podcast. And that is the episode Lift Us Where Suffering Cannot Reach. Mm-hmm. And this is a great example of an episode of Star Trek that isn't necessarily cut and dry. Right. There isn't necessarily, oh, I agree with this side of the issue and I disagree with that side of the issue. And it's not necessarily that way. There's another episode of The Next Generation with Dr. Timison, played by David Ogden Stiers.
Yeah, and it's a great episode.
Yeah, it's called Half a Life. It's a wonderful episode. And there is no definitive, okay, we're taking Timison's side on this, or we're taking Lwaxana Troi's side on this. So it's not going to be a discussion like that necessarily, but we are going to examine what drives this allegory. And in the case of Lift Us Where Suffering Cannot Reach, it's the whole idea of sacrificing one person for the greater good of society. That's a great example of the kind of topics we'll be hitting here.
Yeah, and all three of the episodes you just mentioned also force us to step outside and look at the idea of the things we do culturally that become normal, normalized, that we never question. You know, and in the episode with Majel Barrett and David Ogden Stiers, you're much better at remembering names of episodes than I am. You know, in challenging the culture of the race David Ogden Stiers is from, she makes reference to a fashion that used to exist on Betazoid, which was women would wear huge hats, and in on top of the hat would be a cage in which there were animals. And she said it was uncomfortable for the women and cruel to the animals. And we finally came to terms with that, you know. So I think that's another service that's done a lot of times, and sometimes it's done very subtly. Sometimes not so much because it's Star Trek, but sometimes it is. And I think having those opportunities is also something that we're going to have a lot of fun with as well.
Yeah, definitely.
And with just the most incredible guests that we have lined up for you. I don't know if we want to give people any any glimpses into what we have in store for them. But today, for sure, we scored a coup because our special guest is the one and only Terry Metalis, who is as great a guy as he is a creator. Because what he did with Picard, particularly in season three, was just stunning.
So many things to unpack in our conversation with Terry. We go from discussing some of the nerdy points, things we observed about season three. We talk about all of that. Plus, we get into some political allegory in the season, which there was quite a bit of. And I think that's not something that's getting a whole lot of discussion, but I think we go there, and Terry is absolutely willing to dig into all of that with us too. And one of the things that we talk about is, and this goes back to our conversation about Ted Cruz, why do conservatives, what is it about Star Trek that appeals to conservatives because of the series, all the series being so heavy on political allegory and it coming from a more progressive set of values? what is it about Star Trek that conservatives attach themselves to? And we're not saying conservatives can't like Star Trek, or because that would be very anti-Star Trek of us, because Star Trek is an inclusive universe. But it's a curiosity. And so that's one of the things that we cover a little bit with Terry on today's episode.
Yeah, well, I think it was one of the best interviews I've been part of. He is just phenomenal. So smart, so generous, and to get a glimpse into his process and his experience with his long-standing experience with Star Trek was just a highlight. So I have no doubt everybody is going to enjoy it tremendously.
Absolutely. Yeah. So our guest today is the great Terry Metalis from Picard season three. I keep saying, this is one of the first things I said publicly about his work on this season of Picard, is that he's done for Star Trek what Dave Filoni and Jon Favreau have done for Star Wars. And that is no small feat, to be able to have not only a success with fans, a success with critics, a success in terms of ratings, and now even some Emmy buzz that's going along with it, some extraordinarily well-deserved Emmy buzz. That's an amazing thing, and it so seldom happens, especially when it comes to some of these nerdier sagas, some of these nerdier, some people call them franchises. I don't like that word, but franchises nevertheless. And also, as you said, he's a hell of a nice guy. So I'm so glad we had the opportunity to talk with Terry. So here we go. Here's me and Mary talking with the great Terry Metalis.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure, with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
First of all, hello.
Hi.
Very good to meet you. I just say I haven't been nervous about anything in a very long time. So
what? I'm nervous.
I mean, I'm nervous about running the video controls. Is this running? I think this is recording. I think we're all anxious.
I am not worthy to be your first guest, guys. Like, come on. This is crazy.
I know many billions of people who would disagree with that assessment. Yeah.
Are you still riding the wave of euphoria after the immense success of all of this? I mean, you've got a download slash ratings hit. You've got a hit with critics. You got a hit with fans. Plus, it's a saga that you're passionate about. I mean, you must be like acutely aware of how rare this is as a thing to happen.
You know, it didn't. It was a slow burn for me. It was surreal because Twitter doesn't necessarily let you feel the success if you look at every corner in the universe, and I was in the beginning. So I didn't necessarily feel the success right away. Then I just left Twitter. And then I started to get a lot of calls around town from people in Hollywood, and started to take a lot of meetings from people who had watched the season, who I deeply respected, and were like really into it. and that's when it sort of dawned on me that maybe there was a lightning in a bottle here. As that started to blow up a lot more, and then the IMAX screening was pretty seismic, and being in that room, and then being with the fans, and it was like Avengers Endgame with the cheering. Then it really started to set in that there was something really special happening. And then things started to just trend on Twitter for weeks at a time. And that was extraordinary. It's been surreal. And then, you know, hanging out with you two. folks. And Bob, you talking about on your amazing show, I had friends texting me being like, Bob won't stop talking about it every morning on your morning show. And they would send me clips from it. And I'm like, this is extraordinary. So it's been a wild ride.
It sounds a bit like your experience shooting some of the scenes. You know, you've talked about how it was almost impossible to be in the moment.
Yeah.
You know, when you're on Enterprise Day with the entirety of the original cast of Next yeah. Generation, and you've got 2 days to nail what has been in progress right. for 6 months
right
with legends
right
how do you enjoy that, you know, when you're sort of white knuckling it,
little tiny moments mm-hmm. of, oh my God, Lord, get to do this little, like, for just seconds at a time are extraordinary, and then you got to get to work. Now it's amazing. I saw we're in the middle of a big writer's strike.
Yeah.
I was hanging out with LeVar, was on the strike line, and, you know, now LeVar and I are friends, which is a weird thing to say. And we're talking about, we have aspirations to do it again one day, and we have ideas for things on that. And that's really fun to talk about. So, and we're going to see each other again at this Trek convention coming up, and we're all getting a dinner. So that's really fun. And we get to watch it. The finished product is when it's really, that's when I get the goosebumps. Actually seeing them on the bridge with the music and knowing we did it and feeling that's the moment when I actually feel it, but not the making of it was difficult.
As a fan, were you able to watch it afterward without seeing all the seams and the behind the scenes stuff? Were you able to absorb it as an entity in and of itself and enjoy it?
Yeah. Not necessarily the first cuts. Sometimes the first cut would come together and you'd be like, oh, wow. Drew Nichols, my longtime editing partner that goes back to my show 12 Monkeys, and my composer, Stephen Barton, my new composer, Freddie Weidman. When we started to put those pieces together, you don't see the production aspect of it anymore. You really do feel like it's Picard, it's Riker, it's those folks, and that all that stuff falls away, and you really do you feel like you're in the movie, that really helps.
So what was your first love in terms of all this stuff goes? I think we're all generally part of the same generation coming up at around the same time. Was it your entree, was your gateway drug in all of this? Star Wars, Raiders, Ghostbusters, that sort of thing. Like, what was the first thing that you saw that said, you know what, this is my planet, this is my world? What was that first thing for you?
It's hard, if it was the chicken or the egg here. It was, I was born in 75. So I always had the original series on. Mm-hmm. My dad always had that on.
You grew up in New Jersey, right? So you're watching it on Channel 11?
WPIX? WPIX, New York.
Yep. Represented.
Yes. Yes. You would know it well, wouldn't you? Yeah. I've read your book. Yeah. So it's the... it was that, and it was, and of course it was Star Wars, it was Sunday afternoons, with Star Trek. So it's hard to tell exactly where it began, but yeah, it was certainly those, Star Trek had the, you know, certainly for your show was the entry point for morality, for morality lessons.
And, yeah.
And for first interracial kiss and diversity right away. And so that was important.
Yeah, Terry, I wanna dig into that a little bit more, because these are very different universes, Star Wars and Star Trek, and we can love both of them for very different reasons, but Star Trek, as you say, always resonated because of, I mean, maybe as kids that we didn't notice the diversity and that kind of thing, but also the camaraderie and the idea of a greater good. And what's always struck me, particularly as the iterations have become more frequent, is that the people who participate in the making of Star Trek franchises really seem to subscribe to the show's ethos. And I've always found that fascinating. Plus, of course, you guys always seem to get along so well. Like, you genuinely appreciate, respect, and like each other as the characters in the original series and going forward do. Is that just luck? Or do you think there's something else at work here?
Oh, that's interesting. I don't know. I don't know. I could be quite a, I could be a little bit of everything. I think if Star Trek is in your DNA, then it becomes part of who you are as a person, and embracing the infinite diversity and infinite combinations, and probably as part of being as open-minded as you can, and embracing as many different opinions and kinds of personalities and people. So you hopefully will get along with as many kinds of people as you can. Mm-hmm. Can be hard. You know, so maybe there might be something to that. That's interesting.
Yeah, I would say Michael and Denise Okuda are prime examples of that in terms of not only their expertise, but in terms of how they themselves embody the values of Star Trek. It's kind of an amazing overlap. I mean, if there are Star Trek characters existing in our modern real life right now, I would have to say, I mean, apart from the cast members, I would say Michael and Denise Okuda are those people. They are sort of time travelers from the Star Trek universe in our modern time, saying, hey, keep an eye on this. Keep an eye on these stories that we're telling, because they mean something and they're telling you something about your lives. And to me, that's really what Star Trek is kind of about. It's kind of giving us a message from the future to say, if you can stay on track, if you can make these decisions in the right order, in the right way, with these ideas and these values in mind, you can end up in this amazing utopian future.
It was a really big deal to have Mike and Denise back for this season. You know, they go back to, so when I moved out to Los Angeles to be an intern on Star Trek, I was an intern for Star Trek Post, which was both Deep Space Nine and Star Trek Voyager. I was working for free. I was getting college credit. And so one of the things that I would love to do was sneak out of Post and hang out at the art department, just because I had all the Okuda books, and like I literally had their baseball card. They had a Topps baseball card with Mike and Denise Okuda. And they
you win.
They took me under their wing. And then I became a PA. I would still hang out with them in their art department. I remember specifically they had chocolate covered espresso beans, and I would get all hepped up on that. Had my heart beating way too fast on those. Denise would give me those. So and I stayed with them, and I became an assistant, but through Enterprise. So there was a large swath of my life hanging out with the Okudas. So bringing them back onto this show was so important to me, and having them embrace the season the way they did was like being officially blessed by it. And then, it was a very emotional, important aspect of the season, was having them love it the way that they did.
There was a meme going around the other day on Twitter, Terry. It was Dax's same-sex kiss from that reunion episode of DS9. I think it was season 4. And this guy reacted by saying, oh, Star Trek is just for lefties now. it's, oh my God, it resembles San Francisco. I remember that part about it.
Nice. Wait till they find out where Starfleet headquarters is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love that you called him a chucklehead, by the way. I love the Rickles reference. That was outstanding. Yeah. So, I mean, what doesn't he get about Star Trek?
It seems probably like just about every aspect. It seems like it. You know, it is an odd thing to me that there are hardcore conservative Star Trek fans. It feels as though they missed almost every point of it. But I guess I'm glad that maybe there are, that maybe some of it will seep through. Like I have friends that are conservative friends. Like I don't ban my conservative friends. I don't kick them out of my life. I don't. I find that if there is a method of a window of communication, then there is a window to get new ideas. And sometimes we find common ground, and there are ways. And so that maybe there is a way through different things to get new ideas. So maybe there's hope for us to find ways to talk, but it is surprising. It is often surprising that, you know, and some of these things that the Star Trek is woke is the other thing that is the new one that I'm just like, Star Trek is the word woke is almost driving me.
Well, they can't define, a lot of people who use the word can't define, I've never used that word in my life, but those who use it most seem not to be able to define it. And, you know, I think Bob and I were talking about this the other day. Is it possible it's because things that used to be simply about, you know, equality and social justice have become politicized? So things that everybody used to want, at least theoretically, have fallen down on either side of a divide. And maybe we're just in this particularly challenging period of time when, you know, the things that used to unite us as Star Trek fans, from regardless of what our politics are, kind of keep us apart, and that it's just a temporary situation and we just need to kind of get through it and hope that that's going to stop being the case.
I hope. Like, does the trailer for Empire Strikes Back come out today and Lando Calrissian is considered woke? Like,
right. You know,
like is that, you know, I don't, that's insane to me, but like, but maybe, like, I really don't know. Maybe it is a phase. I often wonder where, like, what started it. Like, this is the right conversation, right? Your Trek politics. Like, was it the moment that they ran Hillary and Trump? Like, was it the moment we took the most polarizing candidates? And that the world sort of just went, you know, into two, or does it go back even farther? Like, I don't know at what point we started this incredible cultural divide. It feels like it was then that at what point did the pendulum start to swing so far that everything started to overreact in every which way? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I've kind of pegged that at about 1980, I would say, where Reagan's Republican Party kind of entered into this union, this coalition with the religious right. And at that point, that's when you start to get the culture wars inserted into politics. I mean, obviously, we'd seen pockets of it. But I mean, I have this theory about conservative Star Trek fans. I'm going to go back to that real quick. My grandmother used to see Liberace on TV and wonder, when is he going to take a wife?
Right.
I wonder if maybe conservatives just haven't noticed the allegories. Like, they're too busy watching the space battles or listening to the music. I don't know what. They're seeing something else in Star Trek and missing the message, the values in there. Or maybe they're just deliberately ignoring that. I mean, that could be a real thing, too. I imagine sort of like, what was it, the ancient Aztecs looking out on the horizon and not seeing the conquistadors and their ships coming toward the shore to invade and occupy that land. Maybe it's that. Maybe it's just this self-delusion.
The counter argument that you often they hear is, I don't like to feel hammered over my head with it. Is the argument you, yeah. you hear. So where is the degree of hammering? Like, who yeah. measures the degree of what is hammered?
You know, I think what I found really interesting is that the original series, a lot of times, what they were willing to explore was about as subtle as William Shatner's reading of the Constitution to the Yang.
Right.
You know, it's speaking of hammering.
Yeah. And oh, my God.
In a lot of ways, that's sort of the legacy of the show, that there is no pulling of punches and people are going to be who they are. And one of the great things about Picard, I mean, the whole show, but you see it even more in season three, is the diversity, and there are all kinds of diversity, mm-hmm. is so organic.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. And so first of all, kudos, because it's the most wonderful thing to see this world that is exactly as it should be. And everybody's comfortable in their own skin and everybody's comfortable with everybody else. And the challenges are external to questions of identity. So thank you for that. I mean, it was one of the most moving things about and most successful things about the season, for sure.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, I don't know that I can take the most credit for that. You know, I think we try and do that with as many people as we can, you know, and you want to check into a lot, you know, we check in with Michelle heard a lot, always kept us honest to not just with it's not just in front of the camera. You want to mm-hmm. do it behind the scenes as well, too. You know, there's many aspects that the film and television has failed behind the scenes as well. Yes. So we try and get that right as well. Yeah, you know, you try and do try just the best you can in an organic way as possible.
Yeah, and one of the things I noticed right off the bat in terms of season three was the strong presence of women over 50. And this is a great example of the organic nature of Star Trek and the inclusiveness and diversity of it. And that is that there wasn't a deliberate effort to say, let's have 6-7 cast members be women over 50, including our primary villain. But it was natural to Star Trek. And to me, that's why it's so confounding when people go, well, why are they trying to shove their politics down our throats? Well, it's not. It's actually something that makes sense in the universe. It's set up in this world. These are characters that we have seen. I mean, Michelle Hurd being a more recent character, but right. the rest of them, by and large, well, and Amanda Plummer's Vada character, also new. But I mean, by and large, the characters that we're looking at in this story of season three, these are all established characters in the Star Trek universe, and then bringing them all together, suddenly that light went off over my head. I said, wow, that's an incredible thing. And it's so rare for that town, even now. By town, I mean Hollywood. It seems like it's a town that's still, even in 2023, resistant to casting women over even the age of 40 in many of these roles. And I think that's maybe a great example, Mary, of what you're talking about in terms yeah, of the totally. Organic nature of no, it. Yeah.
Thank you. You know, I don't know what, you know, again, it's not my intention. You know, The last show I did, 12 Monkeys, we ran 4 years, and I shared some of the DNA of the season, shared some producers as well. And we did the same thing that starred amazing German actress Barbara Sukowa, and a lot of same over 50 or older women too. I don't know if it just, we were all drawn to find that more interesting, maybe because you just don't see it on television a lot, but we did the same thing and we got a lot of the same criticism. I don't know if we just were drawn to writing a more matriarch story. I don't know. That's interesting. Something I didn't really consider until now. Same thing, villain too. The villain was very similar to an Amanda Plummer thing. But I think it's just because it is not the norm. It is something you don't see in big, large science fiction canvases like that, you know. I think Battlestar Galactica, I think probably, which is the, I think, you know, obviously I saw, you're going to have Mary McDonnell on, which I want to bow before her. I was actually at the series finale screening.
Oh my gosh.
For that. And met her there. And I just wanted to just, I mean, that series to me is the end all be all.
I totally agree.
But that is a great example of can do no wrong in that regard. So I think maybe there's some of that. But
I think it has to do with what you said earlier, that if you grew up in the Star Trek universe and you follow it, and you probably unconsciously, because, you know, again, I was really young when the rerun started. Like, that's how I wasn't watching it, you know, when it was still on broadcast television. That's not what I'm saying. When the first three seasons were ongoing, it was in syndication. And I just thought Lieutenant Uhura was like one of those coolest things ever. I didn't think about anything else about her except that she's this incredibly cool woman.
Right.
So you grow up with that and it becomes normal. So you don't have to seek it out. You know, when you're casting or when you're coming up with the storyline, it's just part of you as much as it's part of this incredible universe that Gene Roddenberry kicked off for us, what, 60 years ago now?
It's yeah.
Incredible. So, and I think that's why it works, because it's not intentional in an artificial way.
Well, that's the thing about Star Trek. You've got to be thinking on several different levels at the same time. I mean, yeah. I can't even imagine the whiteboard in the writer's room, and it had to have looked like, you know, like that scene in True Detective where he's got the storage space and the push pins and the, and the yarn connecting and the map. And I mean, the complexity of putting that season together was just immense. And this is, you know, politics, culture, allegory aside, the process of doing that, where you've got an ensemble cast and they all have something that they need to be doing. They need to have individual arcs. They need to crisscross in some way. I mean, the process of breaking this season had to have been, I mean, I'm just watching this going, how did they do this? How did you get all of these puzzle pieces to connect the way it did? It is an extraordinary feat. It's lightning in a bottle. Where do you start in that process, and how do you get to that end point with all of these moving parts?
Well, I think what most people don't understand is, and you see this a lot on social media, which is, well, how come they didn't blah, blah, blah? How come they didn't do this? Or why didn't they think this? Or did they think that? It's like, well, we might have, but you also didn't understand the time clock that we had. Which is essentially, you have 48 hours to write that script or develop that break, while people are knocking on your door, while you have to be pulled away to edit, while actors are asking for their time with the story. So it is, you don't have the luxury of all the time in the world to work out all the problems to, I mean, that would be incredible. That's, I think, the misconception of how stories are put together in television is the luxury to go down every avenue, discuss every aspect politically, how it affects story, character, gender, every aspect of the rainbow, if you will. You just don't. You try your very, very, very best. But eventually, you've got to get that to stage because someone has to shoot it. And that's it. And there's a budget.
Right.
You know, right. And then you got to write it. And then sometimes you write it and they say, nope. Or you do write it. And then an exec goes, I don't like it. So you got to change it. Or an actor says, I don't like it. Or someone says, I'm not going to say it. So there's all those things too. That doesn't necessarily answer your question, but it is, there's usually the broad concept is, here's the story. I think we're heading in this direction for sure. I mean, it started basically with the fundamental idea that it was about legacy. It was what we pass on. It was about what if Picard had passed on the worst part of himself to his son. That was the last story. And I was fascinated by that as a father. I look at my kid, man, you know, you smile when you see the best traits of yourself. And then when you see the worst parts of yourself, you get like, oh my God. Oh
yeah.
Oh, it gets that from me.
Yeah.
You know? And so that's always fascinating to me. So that's the core of it. And so that sort of dictated the whole story. And you do that with a room of unbelievably talented writers, and you flesh out that story as fast as you can.
Yeah, and actually that reminds me of something I want to ask you, but before I do, I just want to point out that by making the extraordinarily difficult choices you made, by not inviting every single person back, who of course you would have wanted to include, you know, you allowed space for some just stunningly poignant moments with the people who were there, which again, another incredible gift. But I'd also heard you say in another interview, you know, the idea of killing off a character. And a lot of people often refer to that as a brave move, you know, because you're challenging the audience or you're upsetting the audience. But I think what you guys did in this season was much braver. And it was allowing these people we grew up with, admiring, wanting to emulate, idolizing in some cases, incredibly strong people, and making them so vulnerable. Especially Jean-Luc Picard. So can you talk about that a little bit, about how that worked out with the actors and what they contributed to that? Because there are a couple of moments there that I think would have challenged us in ways that just killing somebody off would not have done.
We were fortunate that all the actors were more than willing to go there. Certainly, nobody was particularly driven to just play the characters as they did in the 1990s. You know, nobody wanted to just, nobody was like, let's just do the next gen characters. In fact, that was everyone right away was like, they just don't want to be doing next generation.
Yeah.
And that's, also a challenge, because in some ways you feel like you're betraying the next generation because you're not doing the next generation. you have to ask yourself, why would Beverly Crusher not tell Jean-Luc Picard about her son? So you really have to justify that as best you can, with character and story and whatnot, in ways that you're like, ugh, I don't know. But ultimately, I think we got there. I think we, yep, you know, and justified it in a pretty solid way. So the good news is they all really want to go there. And Gates is fully embraced that and went to places and freaks, my God. We went to places with Riker that I never thought we would be able to pull off. And then bought it back, you know, because that's the other thing, is you don't want misery porn with the next gen cast.
Right. Exactly.
You know what I mean? Like that's not where you want to be. You don't want to do 6 feet under. And just be like, thanks a lot for making me feel miserable with the Star Trek Next Generation. Because like you want to see them be joyous and be on the bridge and laugh with them too. Like that was very important. Like you just didn't want to live in that space forever with them. Because you would hate that.
That's right.
That's what you did. Misery porn with the next gen cast. So
I can imagine like pitching to Patrick Stewart. Hey, the next gen cast, but you're running a funeral home. What do you think?
Well, you know what? But again, like they would love to nothing more than to, because they, you know, to play these are master thespians. They would love to do that. You know, Patrick Stewart would be, absolutely. I will. He'll cry for 45 minutes straight. He's a fantastic.
He's a Shakespearean actor. He can do anything.
So, at the same time, you have to make sure that you're going to. Again, that's why it was so important to me at the end that you spend time with them playing poker, seeing them laugh, see those actors be themselves. Like that's them laughing at the end.
Yeah.
That's them improvising. That's them. I wanted people to feel like what it's like to hang out with the next gen cast, and have that special moment that the rest of us have when we're hanging out with them. So you could buy all that back if you were like, oh, thanks a lot. Like I had to watch Beverly Crusher and Picard argue about their baby. Thanks for that. At least you got to see them play poker and have fun by the end. You know what I mean? So, that was important, but television has evolved, right? We weren't going to do of the week. And again, some fans were like, this is not next gen. This is not, we weren't seeing Measure of a Man. I was like, no, we weren't doing next gen. We were doing very much Star Trek 11. You know, we were doing another, this was cinematic universe Star Trek. That was what we set out to do, one last big movie. So that meant you were going deeper into their characters and challenging them and seeing vulnerability in that way. So, you know, it's scary. It is scary to go there because you are going to lose people. And we knew that. But it's also exciting. It was exciting to see Brent Spiner play 5 different characters in the span of 45 seconds. It was exciting. By the way, LeVar went into that space where he's telling Data how broken he was when he died. We'd never really seen Geordi go to that place to Data before. And, you know, when we shot it, we were like, wow, we got emotional, but we didn't know how the fans were going to react. So,
yeah, and along those lines, when you saw the super positive reaction to Captain Shaw, Todd Stashwick's character.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, crap, we kill him later. Spoiler, sorry.
Yeah.
did you come up with a way to, like, did you start thinking at that point, okay, well, if we do Legacy, here's how we're going to bring him back. I mean, was there a sense of panic about, like, oh, my God, everyone loves this character and he dies. What do we do now?
No, there was no. Captain Shaw is dead. There was always a Todd Stashwick in Legacy, but Captain Shaw is dead. So there was, but there was from minute one, there was always Todd Stashwick and Lee. That's all I'm going to say. And it's awesome and it's amazing. And we've always loved it. And I was hanging out at Jerry's with Todd. And
as one does.
Yes. Yeah.
And Todd had this pitch for this episode in Legacy. God bless if we ever do it. That is amazing. And he was pitching it to Jerry and how to play it. And it was the greatest thing ever. And again, it's always been baked in the DNA of an idea even before. So no, we were never worried. It was always the art. I'm just glad that the audience embraced Todd, because I love Todd and he's one of my best friends. And so I loved him from 12 Monkeys. So when we were in the room writing the character, we just wrote Captain Stashwick. So Captain Stashwick comes in and we knew exactly how to write him right away. And so it was one of the easiest things we had ever written. So it's flattering for all of us, for Todd, for the writers, that they have embraced it. And then I don't know if you saw that, but they have announced this beautiful 12-inch action figure of him, that this X6 thing, and that like it's going to be amazing. Like that. So
that's so cool.
That's the coolest thing ever.
Yeah.
I've already started to figure out where I'm going to put it back here.
It'll go great. Yeah. Trying to get them to make a Titan. They're trying to get them to make a Titan captain's chair for it. So
it's going to spin, of course.
Yeah. You're right.
All right. Just making sure.
Well, then you got to make a 7.
But I noticed you beat the living crap out of your friend Todd Stashwick in this season. I mean, compound fracture of his leg. I think at one
point. That is a tradition. Goes back from 12 Monkeys. Every season I beat the shit out of him.
Todd, you're totally screwed in this season. We're going to beat you up several times, and then we're going to kill you. And so good luck.
Right. No, it goes back to, so there's an episode in 12 Monkeys where he plays a very particular kind of asshole. He's sort of like a sociopathic Pete Venkman. In 12 Monkeys, and these characters trying off him in one of the episodes, and so they take him out to a place and essentially they're good fellowsing him. They're gonna off him. At the end of the episode, he comes back limping, near dead, and instead of like seeking revenge, he's like, nicely done. And from there on through, there's just a respect level with those characters but he's just beaten to an inch of his life. So from there on through every season, I take him to a place like that. And that's our tradition.
It's like at the end of every episode about Battlestar Galactica, when there's a cartoon version of Rondi Moore and his, I guess, producing partner. And one of them beats the shit out of the other one. Yeah. And it's just in new and creative ways every single time. And it's, so yeah, it's like that.
It's like that.
So you said the Shaw dead naming thing. That was intentional. That was where he refers to Seven as her human name before she was assimilated. That was kind of the idea that he's pulling that kind of stunt.
Yeah, we didn't strictly say dead name. I mean, it was we knew it was he wasn't going to refer to her as a Borg name. Mm-hmm. And then, as you know, in the writers' room, certainly with our queer writers, it became a dead naming like allegory, but it's not exactly a one-to-one allegory, because you know the trans community is not necessarily the Borg in that way, but massacre people at the Battle of Wolf 359. So, but it is definitely an identity allegory in that way. That aggression. And it was interesting to watch that that play out on social media too, because people really hated him and then came to really love him by the end. It came to kill this guy to you better not kill this guy.
Right.
By the end, which was really something.
But the other thing about that character's complexity, which is I thought fascinating, is that he's actually right about a lot of stuff. He's right about, you know, the breaking the rules and going against protocol, and he has every reason to be pissed off about some things. So all the rest aside, he has a point. And that's that starts way back in season one. I mean, there's so much insubordination going on in that show. Going forward, it's kind of incredible. Like, this is the first time I think anybody's even noticed.
Yeah, I mean, which was risky for us to play, because Riker and Picard are straight up breaking the rules, but it's okay because you love them. And they're doing it to rescue their friend. So the audience is with them, but it's not good.
Exactly.
They're doing. But it was an interesting dynamic to play.
Yeah. Oh, I thought it was fascinating. Actually, it's one of my favorite parts about it, because it was so out of left field.
Right.
Like, nobody questions the great Jean-Luc Picard.
Right.
So, yeah, I loved it.
Was the Neo Constitution class vessel. Oh my God. First of all, genius idea. When I first saw that in the very first trailer, I said, oh my God, they're really onto something with season three. This is going to be really incredible, because it screams out Star Trek. It's, you think of that design. Who's responsible for the design of Titan A, and who came up with the original idea? Let's do this. Let's go down this road and kind of bring back that Constitution class look for this particular ship.
So that came about, thank you. So that came about, we needed a new hero ship. And I was looking at a lot of the designs going forward. And we had just designed the Stargazer, and I had for season two, and I was bringing things back to a saucer section. Everything had the Enterprise E and the Enterprise F was heading in a real sort of arrowhead forward kind of spoon-like design. Things were getting real chonky, and battleship, which I rationalized for, you know, the Dominion War and things. But we brought in, you know, again, it was John Eaves, everybody who had been designing these ships. And we kept heading forward, and the designs just kept getting too advanced. So, and I had designed the nacelles on the Stargazer. I had harkened back to the sort of Art Deco movie era design already. I had sort of brought them back towards the Kirk movie era. Then I saw this fan named Bill Krause had made this kind of quasi what I call the neo constitutional design of this, it's called the Shangri-La class ship. That was like kind of a new Constitution class ship. And I showed it to Dave Blass. I'm like, I really liked this ship. What if we added our nacelles and tweaked it a bit? And so Dave Blass, our production designer, reached out to him. We got the design. We handed it over to one of our ship designer, Doug Drexler, who kind of made some changes a little bit to fit our aesthetic a little bit more. And then that became the Titan. And then we rationalized a few design tweaks and why Starfleet might be going a bit more retro. Got a whole lot of shit from some Starship nerds. But it was okay. And then some trailer came out, got a lot of whiplash from some Star Trek fans, and then a lot of love from some older Star Trek fans. And then it came out, and then a lot of love. I think once it's people started to see it in action, people start to fall in love with it. And that's the case with most Star Trek ships. It goes back to like the Enterprise D. I remember when they debuted the Enterprise D. I remember when the first time they showed it, people were like, "What the hell is this thing?" Because it looked nothing like it. And then people embraced it and fell in love with it, and it became a thing. It was just getting back to the saucers, getting back to a little old school Star Trek. The underdog was, I really wanted the ship to feel like an underdog this season.
Oh yeah.
Feel, you know what I mean? And just be like, that thing is going to just get its ass kicked all season. and that was the spirit of it. And I knew the ending was going to be Seven of Nine becoming commander of the Enterprise, and that this was going to be the story of the origin of the new Enterprise, that this was going to be its maiden voyage, and that the fact that it had been commandeered by the crew of the Enterprise, they were just going to rename it the Enterprise. And it needed to look like the Enterprise. So that became the Enterprise G.
There's kind of a methodology about that too, in terms of if you're not a fan and you see a particular silhouette of something, like for example, Batman, immediately recognizable as just a silhouette. Some of the great aesthetics in these various nerd universes that we dwell in have that kind of thing where you immediately recognize what it is, whether you're a fan or not. And that's what the Constitution class, I think, brought to Picard season 3. Anyone watching a trailer or catching up GIF somewhere on social media and seeing that shape, that design, went, oh, new Star Trek. Maybe I should check that out. That's immediately recognizable.
Right.
There's a method to this that goes beyond this, what I consider to be a derogatory term. And I hope this goes away eventually, like the term Mary Sue. I hope fan service dies as
it,
an.
It is a really strange thing, this fan service term. It's like the word service is awful too.
It's not, again, I
liken it to what is it, 56 years now? Is that what it is? Is that what we're talking to? Okay. So, and I've been saying this to death, people must really hate it, but you walk into somebody's house and they've lived there for 56 years.
Mm-hmm.
They've got stuff on their walls for 50 that they've lived in. They've got furniture. They play music that they like for 56 years. You're going to sit there and shame them for it. Like that's the house they've lived in.
Right.
So if you, it means you're running into stuff in the universe, because it's a 56-year-old universe. It's not, you're not serving anything. It's just what it should be. I have a fundamental difference. I think it can be egregious and looking. I suppose it could be a fair criticism. I would say Moriarty was probably the most egregious thing that I added to it.
That was fine,
but I don't give a shit. I wanted Moriarty in it. He's awesome. But the rest, we really tried to be as organic as possible in it. Otherwise, we could have easily just started the season with them on the Enterprise D bridge. It's no problem. We could put them all on the Enterprise. It's no big deal. They're back. But we didn't.
Well, because, you know, it's that tension between familiarity and evolution. Mm-hmm. Like you said, you can't have the crew from the 90s being exactly the same, because how weird would that be? Really weird. It would not speak well of them as individuals if they haven't evolved over 3 decades. So, and it's science fiction. Some technology sticks around longer than others, and other technology advances. So like I feel like you gave us the best of both worlds by having plenty of touchstones to keep us grounded in this universe we love, with these people we love, but allowing us to, or I should say, allowing all of you and your creativity to kind of push the envelope to advance the story. And that's that is so important to keeping things relevant and alive, I think.
Well, plus, in a sense, I just want to add that we're talking about essentially the finale of The Next Generation, which lasted 7 seasons. It's a lot of storytelling and a lot of aesthetic references in the process of telling that story. And then you get to the final act of this, which I still contend, Terry, is not just one movie. I think Picard season 3 signifies a trilogy of movies. We got movies 11, 12, and 13 in Star Trek Picard season 3. And so you can't conclude those stories without referencing the things that led up to that point. In other words, imagine getting to Act 3 of Raiders of the Lost Ark and suddenly Indy and the cast are in the story of Ordinary People or something like that.
That would be quite a crossover.
So yeah. Vadix cigar smoking. Yeah. I just happened to rewatch The Undiscovered Country the other day. Mm-hmm. And there's a changeling, not the same kind of changeling, a different race of changeling, smoking the same kind of cigar in Star Trek VI.
Yeah.
Maybe shape-shifting species have a thing for cigar smoking or something like that. I don't know.
That's a coincidence, actually. That's a coincidence. We didn't think of, Amon,
Amon, yeah.
That's a coincidence. The smoking thing came from Amanda Plummer, I think.
Wow.
We just thought she should have a little bit of business, and it's Amanda Plummer, and I'm thinking Pulp Fiction, and just like, you think you should be smoking? And she's, and Amanda Plummer is a smoker in general. I mean, she would smoke those fake cigarettes and then go outside and have a full cigarette and come back in and smoke them all. It was that came from that collaboration. So yeah, but no, it's a bit of a coincidence.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah. She's fascinating too. Yeah. Also, just Bob's talking about how many seasons there were in the movies, but people also need to remember that when the original Next Generation was on TV, they got 22 to 24 episodes a season.
Yeah.
And that has to, that gives you luxuries you guys absolutely did not have. Obviously that determined a lot of the choices you made, but you know what I'm saying? Like, you're under completely different kind of time pressure.
Well, we had done 20. I mean, cause we did season 2 back to back. So we did 20.
Yeah,
but you know what I'm saying. In terms of a season, you know, so what the original episode is, series had what 140 episodes.
Yeah, I don't think they quite got to 200, did they? It was something like 199 episodes or something like that. What was all good things? Yeah. I don't know. It was up there. It was a lot of television. Yeah.
Yeah. So you got 30, which is just, and to do what you did in that short scope of time.
You mean for the whole series? Yeah.
Yeah, the whole series.
Yeah, I wasn't there for season 1.
Season 1, right.
You meant for season 2, but yeah. But season 2 we did back to back.
That's fascinating.
Sure was.
Wow. Okay, I'm so intrigued now because
this is Mary Trump.
Sorry.
Mind blown. This is
my mind is blown.
Back to back the next day, literally one day we're doing season 2 and then the next day we're doing season 3.
Okay, I'm what kind? How was that reset?
That was impossible.
It
was
hard.
Yeah,
Terry, how on earth did you pull that off? Because
I nearly died.
You never.
Yeah, it was.
You didn't sleep for a year.
I did not. No. I like to say. What's my little go-to line? I took 35 years off my life and put on 35 pounds. It was also a time of COVID too. Like COVID dropped in the middle of it. So, I had to break off, about 9 weeks before season 2 was over to start working on season 3. Yeah.
And that's been one of the things about Picard is that is the seasons are so qualitatively and thematically different. that sometimes I wonder, like, how did you manage? It literally is like pulling a rabbit out of a hat, what you did in season three.
They're all very different. Yeah, they were all different. They were all.
Was the intention from the outset to be an anthology series? Was that the original idea?
They said when I came on, they said they wanted all three seasons to be very different. Yeah, because initially I had said, you have a 2-season pickup. You could end season two with the biggest cliffhanger of all time. If we in build it, and they said no, we want all three seasons to be different. I'm like, okay. So that was the goal, and then we developed season two to be one story, and then season three would be entirely different. And so about 9 weeks into before season two, was Akiva's like, you know, you gotta break off and start working on your season three kid. And I'm like, all right. He's like, what do you want to do? I'm like, I want to do the last Next Generation thing. And they were all very, very supportive of it.
Thank goodness.
It was a thing to, you know, it was pretty crazy.
We'd be remiss if we didn't mention two things. The visual effects, which were hands down some of the best I've ever seen, especially for television. And second of all, the score. Oh my God, the score for this season is one of the greats in the entire saga of all the Star Treks. And I hear not only references to other Star Trek shows and movies, but I hear references to things that we grew up with. It has that sort of classic late 70s, early 80s, bombastic summer blockbuster sound to it that is inherently familiar. I hear hints of John Williams and Alan Silvestri's score for Back to the Future and all these little things, and not that they're being derivative or anything like that. It just has that same vibe. Mm-hmm.
Right. That was the goal. So for season three, I brought on Stephen Barton, who was my composer for 12 Monkeys. Nice. And I literally parked him in the office next to me. Nice. And the goal was to make it sound like the Star Trek films I grew up with.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, the goal is what would Jerry Goldsmith do? What would James Horner do? How can we make it every episode sound like a giant Star Trek movie? Now, the problem with that is when you have a movie, you have weeks and weeks and months to score it. Yep. You have an episode of television, you don't. You know, in television, you're supposed to write it. You're supposed to track it. Means you reuse a lot of cues after a while. And we didn't want to do that. We burned Steven out. And we were spending a lot of money on orchestra. I mean, it was a feature film orchestra. And you don't have that kind of money in television. So suddenly we were, you know, we're scoring sessions and you know, at a time of COVID too, which is more expensive because you can't have brass and string in the same room at the same time anymore. Because of COVID costs. And so, you know, everything's costing more. So by episode 7, Steven's like, help. But it's sounding amazing. Like we've been doing it. We have a feature film score. But we had found this, my editor Drew, we had been temping, found this brilliant score called, I think, Occupation Rainfall, that we'd used it was this movie that no one ever heard of, but we've been using this music in some of our times. I was like, who is this composer? What is this score? This guy named Freddie Weedman. We're like, I don't know who this guy is, but maybe he'll want to do an episode for us. So I sent an email, never heard back. It's because it went to this guy's spam folder. So I called this guy's agent, and he's like, this guy will do a Star Trek episode for you. Young guy. Turns out he's in LA. Literally get him on the phone. Starts scoring for us the next day. This guy's the greatest guy ever. Becomes one of our best friends. Ends up scoring. He writes the big Q, Make It So, the Enterprise D thing.
Which is the best best track of the score.
Maybe the best. Yeah, yeah. He ends up, poor Steven's so burnt out, he doesn't even get to write the big piece. That's okay. Steven gets to write the whole last half of the finale, which has all the great stuff. Steven's written enough. Steven got, like, you got, he's like, man, I don't even, I'm like, Steven, you wrote, set, you're good, Steven. You wrote the Titan theme. You're golden. But we, and then they, together, they wrote the brilliant finale. But it sounds amazing. And they got along amazing. And I love them.
That's so cool.
They're just the greatest guys ever. Could not have been luckier with those two.
Did you go to the scorings, the recording?
Oh, my God, yeah. Yes. Although I missed the big one. I missed that one.
Oh, Make It So.
Yeah, my I did not get the email about that one.
Oh my gosh.
But it's okay.
If I had attended and it was my project, I would have passed out as soon as I heard that music go and be in the control room. That would have been it.
Steven recorded the final cue, the end credits. He re-recorded the big next gen theme for the poker game when it went for the big credits. And when he did, we did it at Warner Brothers. All of Warner Brothers came out there was a crowd listening to the next gen theme. Cameras everywhere. I mean, it was packed. And some of those players played on the next gen movies, played on First Contact, played on Generations, played on Motion Picture. Some of them played on Motion Picture with Jerry Goldsmith.
Incredible.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there something along the way that was just where you had to spend days, if not a week, to triage some sort of crisis? Was there something that just fell apart and you had to scramble to fix it in time?
There's a few things. We almost didn't get Ed Spaliers. There was a visa crisis we almost didn't get Ed, and that would have, I mean, I don't think the season would have worked without Ed. I really don't. And there was no plan B.
Was that because of COVID?
It wasn't because of COVID. It was,
Because COVID was, sorry.
No, it was an embassy. It was an embassy thing. It was just a weird embassy hookup. Hiccup. That was really bad. There was nobody who was going to be able to pull it off aside from Ed.
Wow.
And then at the last minute, I got a text from Ed. He's like, it went through. And it was was great. There was an alternate episode 6 that we almost went down. Set us back a bit, where instead of the Fleet Museum, we went to a sort of a space pirate Tortuga area that was really interesting, with a Naomi Wildman was a character from Star Trek Voyager. It was a grown-up character that we went to. Episode didn't end up working, but we spent a lot of time on it. We broke the whole episode. Enterprise D, building that was a nail biter, because you're building a set from scratch that hasn't been around, and sourcing rugs and paint and things that have not existed. We were literally gluing that carpet on still from when that cast was walking on still.
You said 6 months it took.
Yeah. The Borg cube, the Queen's Borg cube. We had a lighting day. We did a lighting test and it looked like Dagobah. It just didn't look like, it just didn't look right. It didn't look like a Borg cube. And we luckily came in on a weekend. We looked at it, I'm like, this doesn't look right. And we were able to fix it and looked amazing on the day. Things like that nonstop, actually. I mean, I could actually now I can list 1,000 of them. My office is caught on fire.
Oh, my God.
Minor detail.
A giant electrical fire. We had to move to all new offices right in the middle of it.
Jesus.
Wow. Right. Was there a lot of improv on the set?
There's almost no improv.
Wow.
I don't think
there's... Kevin Smith of you. Yeah.
I bet they're Kevin.
No, I mean, because... We would have. We would have if anybody was going to do it, it would have been Todd. But they're just, I can't think of it. You know what was an improv line? Those were the days.
Patrick
line, those were the days, I think, was. The F-bomb was his.
It's
moment.
Still weird for me to hear Star Trek people swearing. And I'm not a prude by any stretch of the imagination, but it's sometimes like, what?
I connected this to canon, the obscenities. I connected to Star Trek 4 when I want to believe that the obscenities in the Star Trek universe reemerged because of Star Trek 4.
Right, because they went back in time. Patrick just did it on the day because he was so in the moment because him and Ed were so good in the scene. So I didn't see it actually until the cut. And I was like, whoa, that happened. But I was like, well, let's look at an alt. And then my editor and Johnny were like, no, we're keeping it. It's too good.
really good.
But it was good. And then, but the other one was scripted with Amanda's, which was fucking solids.
This is great. Can we give a round of applause to Amanda Plummer?
Seriously. I mean,
forever.
Forever.
Yeah. I've always loved her, and to see her in this and that devilish smile of hers.
We had dinner with her this week.
Oh my God.
I it was so funny. I saw everybody at the Chinese theater and then, at the party, there was something about seeing Amanda there that just like melted my heart. I don't know why. She just was so wonderful, so giving, and just like embraced this character. She just loved playing Vanek, just loved it. Was so giddy about it. It was so charming. I don't know another way to put it.
Did she feel as though she was channeling her dad in a sense from
not really. You know, she didn't bring up her father too much. The chair moment was a little bit. But not really. She just, I think there was a freedom to it. It allowed her to go to so many different places at once. Mm-hmm. It was funny. Every time during the screening, every time the Shrike was on the screen, she'd go, "That's my ship! That's my ship!" And she'd clap. She just, in the way that you knew Vadic would too. Like it was special.
That's so cool to hear because I just think she's a phenomenal actor and she embodies her roles in a way that very, very few people do. And there's just something so authentic about her. And that's really great to hear.
Yeah.
Cause she's Lydia just so phenomenal.
Her character Lydia in The Fisher King is just so endearing and incredible. You just want to give her a great big hug. And
she's great in Battlestar. She's got a small role in Battlestar, season 3, I think.
Yeah.
And So I Married an Axe Murderer. Let's not forget that, please.
Yeah.
Terry, I don't want this to stop, but I'm feeling greedy. I hope you'll come back.
I definitely will.
This was phenomenal.
I hope I didn't bore all your listeners on your first podcast.
Seriously, this is fantastic.
Well, thank you so much.
So much, and we will be in touch.
It's been a pleasure.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Okay, that was just ridiculously amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Where is he? Can we bring him back? I've got like 1,000 more questions for Terry.
He has no choice. Of course he's coming back.
Yeah.
But we should probably have some other guests on first.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, we've got the great Jerry Ryan coming up next time. Captain 7 of 9. This is so exciting because it's one of those things where this is the first guest that we'll have that has history with my Star Trek fandom.
That's
going
right.
Back to like the middle 1990s when I was dirt poor, working in radio, making $98 a week, and watching Star Trek Voyager, and just being totally into it. Still building the models, by the way, and which have all been destroyed by a cat at some point or another. But yeah. Suffice to say, I'm looking forward to talking with Jerry Ryan next time around.
I cannot wait. I will be spitting in my chair in anticipation that interview. She's fantastic in other things outside of Star Trek as well. Okay, well, I don't think our first show could have gone any better. Mm-hmm. This is my new favorite thing.
Yeah.
So, Bob, I'm thrilled that we decided to take what started off as mm-hmm. a kind of off-the-cuff remark. Well, I was on your podcast talking about politics, politics, that we made it a reality.
Yeah, yeah, it's an exciting thing. And it's such a great area to dig into, especially given our day jobs, so to speak. Sticking our face in the white hot plasma stream of American politics and then being able to take a break a little bit, talk about Star Trek. It's still kind of in our area of expertise, but it's something that's fun. It's like President Bartlett talking about national parks in that episode of The West Wing. Yeah, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, but this part's fun. So that's what I'm excited about. And, this episode has been sort of the basic format that we're going to be dealing in. It'll be a conversation between the two of us about an episode of Star Trek and specifically the allegory in that episode and deconstructing that and then segueing over to a guest interview. And so you can expect more of the same moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just wanted everybody out there, make it one of your goals in life to put yourself in a position where you have to watch Star Trek for work.
Exactly right. Oh, and by the way, don't forget to like and share and subscribe and circulate this episode all around. We're on social media at Trek Politics on Twitter, at Trek Politics on Instagram. The website is trekpolitics.com. I think you get the trend on the naming convention by now. But we're going to be adding, I don't think we're on all of the podcast platforms yet, but we're going to be adding that as we go. So be patient with us as we get this thing ramped up, but we should be running on all cylinders here coming soon. Running all on all thrusters, I should say. Yeah,
absolutely. All right, that does it for us. Thank you so much for being here. We will see you back next week at the same time with the phenomenal Jerry Ryan. Take care. Bye-bye.